want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thank you for downloading and clicking on the very latest from peterbcollins.com. We are supported by listeners, and here are some new subscribers who've stepped up. Louis Scolari in the Oakland, California area. T. Pat Kelly up north in Sonoma County, California. And location undetected, Alok Bhatt took the 24-hour pass, and I hope he or she will be back. All the details to subscribe are right under my picture on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. In our second segment today, Craig Holman joins us from Public Citizen to talk about how Chevron, the big oil company, broke the law in funneling millions into Republican campaign coffers this past year. And no, it's not a violation of Citizens United. There's actually another law that's still in effect. But first, Jason Leopold returns to our program today. He is the lead investigative journalist at truthout.org and a longtime contributor here at peterbcollins.com. Jason, as always, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Great to be with you.
And we've upgraded our technology, trying to use Skype more than the telephone now for our interviews,
yes.
Which gives us a little better audio sound, and we get to look at each other. Jason, you have been digging into what is a large digital legacy of Aaron Swartz, and many people like me barely knew who he was before his reported suicide on January 11th of this year. He was a young tech wizard who developed the RSS feed, and I'm grateful for that. Many of our listeners access this podcast using an RSS feed, Real Simple Syndication. And he also founded a company that became part of Reddit, and so he was part of the technorati, if you will, and yet maintained an edgy lifestyle. He was only 26 when he passed away. And he was being relentlessly pursued by federal prosecutors over an incident that occurred at MIT a couple of years ago, and we'll get into that. But first of all, you have been taking a look at some of the FOIA requests that Aaron Swartz had filed, and a lot of questions come up, not so many answers about exactly what he was doing in some of his own investigative pursuits. But tell our listeners why Aaron Swartz is significant and what some of the biggest questions are that loom following his, again, reported suicide.
Sure. Well, first of all, I also want to add that he was also a quite a prominent political activist, and he was instrumental in the defeat of the online privacy bill legislation that was out there. You know, Aaron, and that is basically how I came to know of Aaron Swartz, was his political activism. You know, when he passed away, when he took his own life in January, it certainly raised questions, first of all, as to why he felt that you know, such despair. What was happening that he felt that there was no way he can improve his situation, no way out. And I had decided to, you know, do some investigation. And what I found was immediately that sort of provided me with some insight into the type of person he was. I found that, like me, Aaron Swartz was quite the prolific FOIA terrorist, if you will. He filed numerous Freedom of Information Act requests. And many of those Freedom of Information Act requests appear to have been somewhat self-serving, that he was trying to find out what the federal government was up to with regard to his case. But there were also other Freedom of Information Act requests that you know, that he filed, where he was just genuinely curious and wanted to use the tools that are provided to all of us to pry loose information. And this really is representative of what he had campaigned for over the years, which was free access to information. And, you know, before we get into the issues with MIT, Aaron Swartz was also on the government's radar originally years ago, maybe 5 years ago, when he went and liberated these court documents that are housed on PACER, the federal courts on the federal court system online database. And, you know, Peter, court documents are technically free. You know, these are documents that are more or less available or should be available to everyone without charge. So, but where it's located on, or how it's people can access it on PACER, which is, again, the federal court database, normally you pay about 8 to 10 cents a page. But the federal government started to put together a pilot program, and where they would allow people to access all federal court documents via libraries at certain higher learning institutions. And so what Aaron did was he happened to see that a colleague of his named Carl Malamud, who is another sort of open government advocate and put out a call for these free or put out a call to have people send him court documents so he could provide them for free on his website.
Should we call this Judgy Leaks?
I mean, the funny thing is that there's nothing secretive though about mm-hmm. these documents.
They're public records, but there is a revenue center for the government when they make copies and deliver them to people who are interested in them.
Exactly, and so you know what his colleague put out there, and when the government set up this sort of free access via you know several universities and libraries, Carl Malamud went out and said, "Hey, everyone, collect all of this information. Collect these court documents, send them to me, and I'll put them on my website, and everyone will have access to them." What Aaron Swartz did, however, was he figured out how to create a script that he was able to sort of insert online in a program that allowed the downloading of millions of pages of these court documents. And the government claims that it was worth about $1.5 million. So as soon as he started to do that, somebody within these institutions figured it out, or where he was, somebody was trying to access a large volume of these records. And shortly thereafter, it was immediately shut down. But it sparked an FBI investigation. And so that's how Aaron Swartz, at least as far as we know, you know, first arrived or first landed on the government's radar. Mm-hmm. And the FBI investigated. No charges were ever filed, largely because, again, you know, these are public documents, and the government had set up you know, this free access to it at certain places. So, you know, during the course of that investigation, you know, Swartz was also, figuring out other ways to liberate, you know, data, information, excuse me, that should be available to people for free, but that were, behind these paywalls. And that led him to, to download millions of academic journals, again, using a very similar type of script that he did with Pacer. Mm-hmm. And the charges were that he, you know, broke into a wiring closet. It doesn't appear that he broke into anything, but he went into a wiring closet in a basement at a research center at MIT, hooked up his computer, started to download millions of pages of these academic journals from a database, a paid database called JSTOR, and that landed him again on the radar of our federal law enforcement authorities, and they started to aggressively pursue him. And that is how, that was what he was dealing with for the past several years.
And it's interesting because Aaron Swartz at the time was on a panel, what appears to be a think tank based on ethics at Harvard, which is a rival of MIT's in the Boston area. So is there any, you know, suggestion that there was that MIT's initial effort to pursue a case against him for the JSTOR downloads, was that anyhow aimed at the Harvard rivalry?
No, it doesn't appear that is, at least as far as we know, it doesn't seem like that is aimed at any sort of rivalry. But I will tell you, Peter, that as you start to look closer at the acts, you know, or the alleged criminal acts that the government, you know, claims that Aaron Swartz committed, you're left with questions that you sort of have to ask as a result of looking at it is, what was the government really after? What were they really looking at? Because again, he downloaded these academic journals. This was a gifted programmer. He was he was gifted. He had simplified, you know, the lives of many when it comes to, you know, access to information, you know, obtaining news and information. So why were they so aggressive? And within the community that he was, or where he was a part of in Cambridge, this was a very large, you know, hacktivist community. And at the time, the government has also, you know, been very aggressive in its pursuit of, you know, hackers, hacktivists, people associated with Bradley Manning, many of whom come from this community, WikiLeaks. So I don't have any evidence that certainly shows that is ultimately what the government was after. But it certainly appears to be what Aaron Swartz thought that they may have been after with regard to their pursuit of him, because his FOIA requests, his Freedom of Information Act requests to various government agencies, including the FBI, including the Justice Department's Criminal Division, he sought documents related to those issues. For example, he asked for, just prior to his arrest in January of 2011, I believe, he asked the government for, you know, for documents related to Bradley Manning, related to a visit one particular associate of Bradley Manning. His name is David House. He was part of the he's part of this hacktivist community over at MIT and in Cambridge, and he was one who went to visit Bradley Manning early on after his he was moved over to, I think, Quantico. And Aaron Swartz filed a FOIA request asking for the audio that was recorded during the visit that David House had with Bradley Manning. Don't know why he asked for that information, but it was certainly something that Aaron Swartz was very interested in. He also asked the Secret Service, which was involved in the investigation and took over the investigation from Cambridge cops. He asked the Secret Service for documents related to how they read encrypted disks and hard drives. So if you take a look at his, again, his request, it does provide some insight into his thinking, into what he was concerned about, perhaps what he was learning during his own, during his work, you know, during the course of his case, of his prosecution, and even before that. So, you know, that's the very, very long answer I'm providing you with. But again, you know, it just doesn't seem to be that this is a simple case about, you know, the government really just wanting to crack down on an individual for downloading these academic journals.
So, Jason, let's tease out one list here of the agencies that investigated and pursued Aaron Swartz, because, as you pointed out, it was the FBI that investigated the PACER file sharing activities that he is accused of. No charges were filed. And then it was local law enforcement that initially handled the investigation at MIT. But the Secret Service became involved. And I find that really curious because in terms of domestic law enforcement, the Secret Service has dignitary protection up to and including the president. And they deal with counterfeiting issues. But I am not aware of any cyber investigation that would fall to the Secret Service as the primary investigative agency. It seems that given the expanded powers under the Patriot Act, that the FBI would be the natural lead agency here, since agents can write their own warrants, these national security letters that don't require a judge's approval. And so what have you been able to determine? And I notice you cite Marcy Wheeler, who's been a great muckraking online reporter for many years now, speculating about the same issue.
Yeah, no, Marcy is great. She's another fantastic forensic journalist who really dives deep, gets deep into, you know, the weeds and takes a good hard look at some of these documents. And as she noted in one of her blog posts, you know, after his death, that, you know, the Secret Service gets involved in investigations where there is a significant economic or community impact, participation of organized criminal criminal groups involving multiple districts or transnational organizations, and the use of schemes involving new technology. But as she pointed out, and as we know, you know, the downloading of these academic articles, is none of that. It's neither of those things. So again, as you know, why did the Secret Service get involved? And they took over the investigation about 2 days before Aaron Swartz was arrested. So it remains to be seen. I've filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Secret Service, asking that agency. And I filed more than a dozen Freedom of Information Act requests immediately after Aaron Swartz's death. But with the Secret Service, I said, I want everything that you have on Aaron Swartz. First of all, he's deceased, so it should immediately open up that, you know, the document coffers, if you will, and authorize the agency, you know, should be authorized to, you know, release this information, because there's no privacy involved anymore when an individual is deceased. So, you know, I published a story last week that was quite a shock, in which the response I received from the Secret Service was, we cannot provide you, we cannot comply with your FOIA requests, because the investigation into Aaron Swartz remains open. That was quite stunning. And first of all, as I indicated, he's deceased. How can an investigation, the main subject of your investigation is deceased, how can the investigation remain open? So I got on the phone with the Secret Service, which I don't recommend that everyone, you know, do. It's not, or do it with caution.
Press 9 if you'd like a hooker in Colombia.
Right, exactly. Yes. But I just called them up and I wanted to talk to them about their response to my FOIA request. And I spoke to an analyst. The analyst said, and I indicated that, you know, as is standard practice, when a, you know, the subject of an investigation dies, you know, the Justice Department drops all the charges, which is what they did immediately after Aaron Swartz's death. And the response I received from the Secret Service is, well, just because the Justice Department dropped their investigation, it doesn't mean our investigation has ended. In fact, our investigation remains open. And again, that was kind of a red flag. It indicated or it led me to suspect that there were either other targets with regard to whatever they were investigating, even though they say on paper that, you know, their investigation pertains solely to the, you know, downloading of these articles. But it did sort of indicate to me that, you know, maybe there is another target or targets of the investigation. In addition, it could simply have been that, look, they don't want to comply and they are unaware that I happen to be the type of reporter who not only will file an appeal, but will litigate. So I followed up again and I said, look, you know, I just simply do not, you know, buy this response. And the analyst refused to give me her name, which I thought was ironic given, you know, that Obama is so big on transparency.
Hey, what part of the secret and Secret Service don't you understand, buddy?
Actually, that's a good point, Peter. I didn't think of that. But, you know, I then, you know, spoke to the head of the FOIA office, and, you know, after going back and forth, they backtracked and they said that they will reopen my case and that they will begin to process my FOIA and, you know, obtain the responsive records and provide me with, you know, with the materials that I seek.
Fundamentally, doesn't their response suggest that they are investigating alleged conspirators or people who received the illicit proceeds of the illegal document acquisition by Aaron Swartz? I mean, it seems really petty, but
it does. I don't want to read tea leaves and think what they may be doing. As I indicated, they simply could they just may not have wanted to comply. I certainly deal with that with many other agencies where they will send me a response to a FOIA and say they can't give me the materials and they cite some odd exemption, and then I have to go through the appeals process and perhaps litigate. And as you know, that takes, you know, a very long time. And when I finally do receive the materials, it's apparent that, you know, they just did not want to comply. However, we're dealing with you know, Aaron Swartz here, and this is, you know, that's why I mentioned, you know, the possibility that there were other issues at play. You know, Aaron Swartz did leave this very important paper trail, and that paper trail is his own FOIA request. And I wrote a very lengthy story, you know, back in January, highlighting that and saying that and indicating, you know, to readers that it provides insight into, you know, what he was suffering with, what he was trying to find, you know, the information that he was trying to find. So, it, you know, with, again, getting back to this issue with the Secret Service, it really doesn't make any sense. Why were they involved with this? Why were the prosecutors in Massachusetts so aggressive in their pursuit of him? Why did they want to put him away, you know, for years and years? You know, he was charged with more than a dozen felony counts. You know, and if you hold that sort of alleged crime up to the bigger crimes that we've seen, certainly with regard to Wall Street, you know, just let's just show some of the, you know, financial crimes that have taken place. I mean, they were really aggressive. They're like, we want this person in jail for downloading academic journals. And you know, JSTOR, they settled with Aaron Swartz. They did not want to, they did not want to see this pursued. But at the same time, MIT was also pretty aggressive in their pursuit of him. And there are a lot of questions here, Peter. And I happen to think that this is a huge story. It's huge on many levels, because I do believe, and I hope to, you know, at least obtain some more information, whether it's through documents or perhaps interviews with people, that the pursuit of Aaron Swartz wasn't just about this, but it was something much bigger that the government was after, and that could either involve, you know, this hacktivist community, who knew what and when, trying to get Aaron Swartz to either, you know, give up information, become an informant. The pressure that was placed upon him obviously became so great that he felt that he had no choice but to take his own life. You know, I also filed a FOIA request with the FBI. I received those records about a week or so ago. And, you know, there's frankly just less than 24 pages, which I find very hard to believe that that's all that the FBI has. And that involves the, you know, their investigation into his activities regarding Pacer. But it also shows, you know, how they were pursuing him, all the social media sites that they were looking at to obtain information about him. It's, you know, it's questionable. And I think that this is really, you know, gets into the, you know, the war on information, the war on information getting out there, on the larger issue about ensuring that, you know, people who are trying to liberate information the way Aaron Swartz was, to strike enough fear within them and their, you know, colleagues that it just doesn't happen. And I think that, you know, they've succeeded to some extent.
Well, and since Occupy surfaced, and since Anonymous, which we believe originally was a group of critics of the hierarchy of the Church of Scientology, and they kind of diverted their attention into various types of hacking, denial of service, and those sorts of things, after PayPal and others agreed to block funding to WikiLeaks. So, you know, I can visualize that the government sees them as all one piece and, you know, was really trying to take down anyone with what they consider to be cyber warfare intentions. And I hasten to add that I think the United States government is very aggressive in cyber warfare, whether it is against China or Iran or unknown targets. And maybe they felt they were seeing too much sophisticated competition from the hacktivist community. That said, let me just ask a baseline question, Jason. Have you seen anything that raises questions about the nature of his death? Is the story as it has been reported, that he took his own life and there are no other suspicious or contributing factors?
I mean, I have seen people post comments, you know, alleging that he was murdered. But, I mean, you and I have both seen this long enough to know that that's sort of the, you know, immediate reaction people have when somebody is being relentlessly pursued by the government. I honestly think that he did take his own life. I don't think that there's any other explanation. I don't think he was murdered. At all. I think that's ultimately what happened here. And he certainly had put together some blog posts over the years in which he talked about, you know, depression and, you know, going to a dark place. And, ultimately, you know, how that sort of in some instances paralyzed him. And so he was very open in discussing some of the depression that he suffered. So it certainly fits the it matches what he had been, you know, talking about at the time. And I mean, I haven't seen an autopsy report. I don't believe one was performed, but I'm not sure about that. Mm-hmm. But you know, look, his parents basically blamed, or his father blamed, the government, you know, for murdering him. Mm-hmm. And because of their pursuit of him, and there's no question, Peter, that it was aggressive. I mean, look, you know, we have a congressional inquiry into his prosecution at this point. You know, people have been paying tribute to him for months and months and months. Very prominent individuals. He was an incredibly important and gifted individual, and a person who should not have had to face what he was facing with regard to, you know, the prosecution that was moving forward. And you know, one thing I didn't mention is that he wrote back in 2008. He wrote this, or he was one of the authors behind this so-called Guerrilla Open Access Manifesto, and I think that's exactly what it was. That was the title, rather. And the manifesto was basically his lobbying. You know, it was Aaron Swartz lobbying for for making information available for free. In fact, he wrote that we need to take information wherever it is stored, make our copies, and share them with the world. We need to take stuff that's out of copyright and add it to the archive. We need to buy secret databases and put them on the web. We need to download scientific journals and upload them to file sharing networks. So he wrote that in 2008, and he seems to have at least allegedly, you know, followed through on what he had written about. And apparently, you know, a Justice Department representative met recently with Congress and indicated that those words, that guerrilla manifesto played some part in their, you know, prosecution, or at least their aggressive prosecution against him, which would be very troubling. You know, if that happens to, you know, turn out to be the case,
because his free speech rights should permit
exactly.
him to publish that manifesto, and it is not, you know, direct evidence of any criminal intent.
That's exactly it. I mean, I just read it to you. I don't see what is the, you know, where's the crime mm-hmm. involved there? And you know, we do have those or the law that was in place that the prosecutors in Massachusetts claim that they were using is one that I believe Zoe Lofgren here in California, you know, a lawmaker is trying to see changed. But again, if you think about it, you know, if people want to get outraged, I'm sure they're outraged. You know, you think about the way that that these prosecutors pursued this young man. And when have we seen that same type of aggressive prosecution being applied to, you know, the real criminals out there that have, you know, certainly brought this country to its knees?
You mean the medical marijuana cultivators?
Right, exactly. Yes. You know, I mean, it's and that's what makes it so odd, Peter, you know, and that's why that these questions need to be asked. I don't have the answers yet, mm-hmm. but, you know, why not ask those questions? Why are they pursuing him the way that, or why did they pursue him the way that they did, while really leaving, you know, or giving slaps on the wrist, if that much, you know, to these other individuals who are also under investigation and committed far greater crimes.
Many of them wore coats and ties, though, and paid a lot of money for those threats.
Now, they did. And, you know, And he, you know, he had, I mean, he certainly spent a lot of money on legal fees. I think that was clear. But, you know, Aaron Swartz also had, you know, he had money. He had money from his sale of his share of Reddit, you know, the social media site. And he also, what he didn't want is that he did not want to strike a deal with prosecutors. He did not want to plead guilty to a felony, which is what they apparently claimed that they wanted from him. And as you know, Peter, that when, you know, when you're dealing with federal prosecutors, and if they ask you to agree to a plea deal, sometimes they will also state that you have to also cooperate, right, you know, with any ongoing investigation. Mm-hmm. We don't know if that was the case. And I think that the people around Aaron, I don't know what they know and what they don't know. Those individuals who were close to him. But I would certainly hope that, I mean, we know that some of them have also been, you know, forced to testify before grand juries with regard to, you know, the investigation into his activities. But we don't know exactly what the government had offered him, you know, beyond, you know, jail time. But one thing we do know is apparently is that Aaron Swartz did not want to be known as a felon. Mm-hmm. I think he had he aspired to see political office one day or to, you know, to be close to Washington in a way that he could make some changes like he did with that, you know, online privacy bill.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Jason Leopold from truthout.org. He has an updated article published on February 28th about the Aaron Swartz case. I'll link to that in the show file at peterbcollins.com. And appended to the article is about a dozen different documents that you've been able to secure. And you're trying to follow the trail of his FOIA requests in order to try to discover what he was driving at beyond information about his own case investigation and prosecution.
Correct. And in fact, you know, just a little sort of background here on the FOIA requests. When he asked for some of these documents pertaining to certainly, you know, his case, or rather the larger issues revolving around his case, he was denied, or the Justice Department or the various other agencies where he sought these documents said that they did not have any responsive records. So what I've done is I've taken all of his FOIA request numbers. Okay, each FOIA request comes with a specific case number, and I think we've discussed this before, Peter. One or anyone can then ask for what's known as processing notes. Okay, so I've asked, in addition for whatever they have on Aaron Swartz, with, you know, at the Justice Department, FBI, and Secret Service, I also want to know how they handled his FOIA requests, and I have asked for those processing notes because sometimes that can provide us with clues. I believe that this will be, you know, an ongoing story for quite some time. And I think that there is certainly, in my opinion, quite a bit of information that will be found in those documents that will, you know, provide the public with a deeper insight as to, you know, why he was being pursued so aggressively.
And I'm also going to link to an article that was just posted at the website of the Atlantic Monthly a day or two ago, written by Quinn Norton. And she was once Aaron Swartz's girlfriend, remained a friend, and she was drawn into this, required to testify before a federal grand jury. And her confessional article, Jason, raises even more questions. In particular, she discloses that in her interrogation by prosecutors in the Aaron Swartz matter, that she disclosed the existence of the manifesto. And she thought that she was mentioning something that they clearly would have known about. Anybody who'd done a basic internet search with or without Google probably would discover that manifesto. And yet, you know, she seems to carry a great burden of guilt for being the source of that tip to the government, which then seemed to ratchet up their efforts to put the squeeze on Swartz.
Yes, I think that, you know, her recounting of what she went through as well, what they went through together, is important reading. And it certainly showed, to me at least, you know, came across as someone being, you know, somewhat naive, you know, first of all, you know, allowing the Secret Service into your home, and answering their questions and not immediately asking for a lawyer. And by the way, if that happens to anyone, you know, the first thing you should ask for is a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Don't invite it sort of, I don't know, what was that thing with vampires? Don't invite a vampire into your home or something, because, you know, it's like, don't invite, you know, federal law enforcement into your home, and, you know, answer questions and that essentially could be used against you. But I'm not berating her for that. I'm just stating that, you know, she, you know, gave up information or provided information that she did think would be very helpful. And that's understandable given that they were both, you know, she was in a relationship with, you know, a person that she clearly loved and cared for deeply. But it's not clear to me. It's not convincing to me that, you know, that they did not already know about this, you know, this manifesto. I mean, we're talking about the Secret Service, possibly the FBI. We don't know, but, come on, you know, they clearly knew what he was up to. And I think that they probably were, you know, paying close attention to him for some time.
Well, and again, her piece is very personal, and it does certainly convey the pain you go through if you become the subject or a witness to a federal investigation. It can take over your life and force you to lawyer up and spend a lot of money and time with attorneys. And it is quite an ordeal, and she succeeds in conveying that. But at the same time, she raises questions about her own knowledge or lack of knowledge about aspects of Swartz's predicament. And some of it's a little hard to believe that, you know, she was in constant or relatively constant contact with him and yet didn't seem to know some of the specifics about the JSTOR episode and some of the aspects of the investigation. So
now, I'm sorry, are you saying that is hard to believe in terms of believe it literally?
Yes. I mean, honestly, the question arises, did she perjure herself? Because she was claiming that Swartz cut her out of some specific information while he was clearly sharing this ordeal of the prosecution with her. And so
I agree, Peter. I have to say that giving her recounting a close read, and again, this is someone who clearly is, in my opinion, carrying quite a bit of guilt, and I am so sympathetic and saddened for her loss. With that said, she noted that, you know, in this very lengthy, you know, first person account in the Atlantic, that, you know, she's a reporter, she's a journalist, you know, that she was prodding him for information about, you know, the sale of Reddit, how much money he made and some other things. And, you know, she the context in which she, you know, presented that is that, hey, I'm a journalist. But yet when he called her from prison, she didn't ask any questions.
Mm-hmm.
Which seemed kind of odd. If you're a journalist, if you're that type of if you're that type of journalist, one would think that, well, you'll be asking those type of questions as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jason, I thank you for staying on this story and pursuing the trail that Aaron Swartz left behind, and I hope you'll update us when additional information becomes available.
I certainly will, Peter.
Jason Leopold, lead investigative reporter at truthout.org. Time for segment two on the Peter B. Collins Show. It's very clear that our campaign finance system, as this U2 song would suggest, is out of control. And while citizens across the country gather petitions and attempt to pass a constitutional amendment to correct the misdeeds of the Supreme Court in Citizens United, there's another issue that has surfaced about a corporate campaign contribution that appears to violate a different federal statute not related to Citizens United. Craig Holman returns to our program today. He is a lobbyist, one of the good ones, who lobbies for us on Capitol Hill and in Washington, D.C. He's with Public Citizen, and their website is citizen.org. And Public Citizen is asking the Federal Election Commission to take enforcement action against Chevron for its $2.5 million contribution last year to a Republican-tied super PAC. Craig, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here, Peter.
Now, under Citizens United, I thought that corporations of all types could just pump unlimited amounts directly into candidate campaigns or into some of these super PACs that don't have to disclose their donors. So what's the wrinkle here? How did Chevron end up in your sights?
There's a special class of corporations that are not allowed to make campaign contributions to party committees, candidates, or political committees, and that's government contractors. This comes from a long and seedy history of government contractors trying to curry favor with those who award the contracts by handing them cash in the form of campaign contributions.
Mm-hmm.
It's been such a problem that ever since 1940, government contractors have been banned from making campaign contributions at the federal level. And today, 15 states and the Securities and Exchange Commission have joined in that legislative movement, banning government contractors from making campaign contributions. Now, we had this disastrous, as you mentioned, Citizens United decision from five justices of the Supreme Court back on January 21, 2010. But Citizens United, even though it opened up the gateways for unlimited corporate spending in elections, it did not in any way address the law that banned that special class of corporations, government contractors, from making campaign contributions. So that law is still in effect. And the FEC recognized that, by the way, in a similar case back in 2010, when some government contractors made a contribution to another super PAC that was involved in Alaskan federal elections. So this law is still on the books. And a few corporations seem to have either not realized that or else believe that the Federal Election Commission may not be enforcing the law anymore. And Chevron Corporation is the biggest offender of that practice. And that's why we filed the complaint against Chevron today.
Craig, what is the scope of government contracting that Chevron currently enjoys? I'm aware that they're a primary supplier of fuel to the Defense Department, and this surfaced not in the hearings, unfortunately, but among bloggers critical of the nomination of Chuck Hagel to serve as Secretary of Defense because he just resigned from the Chevron board, where he was making six figures to show up for meetings four times a year. But he did, as Condoleezza Rice did before him, leave the Chevron board to rejoin government. The issue was raised, as I say, in the blogosphere, but not to my knowledge in the confirmation hearings.
You can check out the government contracts yourself on the webpage called usaspending.gov and type in Chevron or Chevron Corporation or Chevron USA Inc., and you'll see hundreds and hundreds of government contracts come online there. I've tallied at this point somewhere above $1.5 billion coming through 600 different federal government contracts since 2000, going to either Chevron Corporation or Chevron USA, Inc., and actually a whole lot of other Chevron-named companies. So that's where you can take a look at these contracts. Chevron really, when it comes to the energy industry, is classified as the one of the second largest businesses when it comes to energy, and you can see it in their government contracts. It is mostly defense related, by the way.
Mm-hmm. And Craig, when we take a look at this, the revolving door also brought Jim Haines, who was Don Rumsfeld's counsel at the Pentagon, over to Chevron, where he serves as chief counsel. Now, you would think that he has some awareness that Chevron is a government contractor and therefore prohibited from making these super PAC contributions despite Citizens United.
I would certainly expect that. That is why in filing this complaint, you know, I very clearly make the point that I fully expect that Chevron did understand that this contribution would be illegal, violating the ban on government contractors making contributions. And furthermore, I asked the Federal Election Commission to take a look at the Super PAC, the Congressional Leadership Fund, which is directly related to Speaker Boehner in the House. The Chevron contribution of $2.5 million to the Super PAC, which came right during the election of 2012, in October 2012, made up roughly about 22% of the entire budget of the entire Super PAC. You know, if a Super PAC is going to take that kind of money, you'd think they would feel obligated to make sure that the contributions are, in fact, legal and permissible. And so I clearly raise the question, you know, I see no way in which either of those entities did not know this contribution was illegal. To tell the truth, I honestly think they just believe the Federal Election Commission isn't going to enforce the law. The FEC has a fairly long history now, since 2009, of deadlocking on major enforcement decisions and not carrying through with enforcing the campaign finance law.
And does the FEC currently even have a full panel of commissioners?
They do not have a full panel. One of the Democrats left, so they have five members on this commission. They need four votes to make any kind of decision. Now, I can't honestly predict what the FEC is going to do with our complaints. You know, their history of deadlocks would suggest to me that they might not carry through with enforcement. But then I look at that 2010 case where they voted unanimously saying that it is, in fact, illegal for government contractors to make a campaign contribution to a super PAC. And that gives me some hope. You know, hope if for no other reason that the FEC would look exceedingly hypocritical if they turned their back on enforcing the law this time around.
And what other route would you have if it deadlocks at the FEC? Can you file just a direct lawsuit or try to compel the Justice Department to enforce the law related to this illegal contribution?
Public Citizen itself is not likely to have standing to file a lawsuit here. The money, Chevron's money, was used by the Congressional Leadership Fund targeting House Democrats, 14 specific House Democrats. And so for standing for litigation, it would most likely have to come from either of those 14 congressional members or perhaps, the House Democratic Caucus. They're the ones who would have standing, so Public Citizen does not. Hmm. At this point, we are pressing for making sure everyone's aware of the law and sincerely hoping the FEC will determine that the law is in effect here and put all other government contractors on warning that this would be a violation of federal law.
And if our listeners would like to get more information, citizen.org is the website of Public Citizen, and you can find the complaint that was sent to the FEC there and review it. I want to ask you about a couple of other things. Is there anything else you'd like to mention about the Chevron case here, Craig?
sure, one more thing. If the listeners go to our webpage, we are also trying to launch, well, we are launching a petition drive to get citizens to petition Chevron to say, get your money out of politics. So anyone who goes onto our website, please sign on to that petition. You know, this complaints, I mean, we're pursuing every angle possible to try to reduce the specter of corruption here. One is a legal course, and the other is public pressure as well. So please sign that petition, folks.
I like your strategy. I think you do need to pursue both. I wanted to ask if you had any comment. Sheldon Adelson, who owns a big casino operation in Nevada and also in China, in the island of Macau, it's actually a peninsula there at the mouth of the Pearl River. He has filed a document, I think, with the SEC, essentially acknowledging that they paid bribes in China. And I'm curious what your comment on that is, and also, will this in any way make it impossible for him to bankroll campaigns in the future? Is there any proscription on people who've admitted to bribery, even if it's overseas, funding American political campaigns?
It does not prohibit Sheldon from actually funding campaigns hereafter, although he will come under tremendous pressure not to be doing so. I mean, which candidate is going to want to be aligned closely with Sheldon Adelson money?
Well,
if he
let's
gets convicted.
Let's list them: Newt Gingrich, Rick Perry, Mitt Romney. Did I leave anybody out? Did what's his name from Pennsylvania, Rick Santorum? Did he take some Adelson money? I can't remember now.
He did, but keep in mind that was when there were allegations that Adelson, you know, might be involved in some sort of corrupt activity, but no one really knew that yet. You know, if it gets to the point where Adelson actually gets convicted of violating bribery laws, especially in China, that's when, you know, candidates, I think, are going to run away from Adelson. But I also want to emphasize, I mean, this has got to apply greater pressure on those five justices of the Supreme Court who ruled for Citizens United to rethink what they're doing to our democracy. I mean, the whole point of having reasonable limits on how much money any individual can throw into the elections is so that they can't buy formal favors. They can't bribe candidates. Here we see unlimited funding of super PAC activity and the candidate super PACs through Adelson by a person who may well be convicted for doing exactly that type of bribing activity in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
This has to, like, raise red flags in their minds. But we'll see. We haven't seen that yet.
Well, Craig, you've been in the Beltway for a long time, and you've still got a moral compass. I'm a little concerned about you.
Tell the truth, it's been a little rough lately. You know, as a campaign finance reformer, we were winning most of the time in courts as well as in the legislatures and in Congress. And the last couple of years have been a little rough. But, you know, we'll get it back.
I mean,
we cannot continue this democracy in this type of fashion.
Well, but I do think
a scandal.
I think the court did at least briefly revisit the issues with the Montana appeal last year, and in a one-line summary dismissal, they just said, "Nope, we already made up our minds here. Corporate money can flow." And I don't know if you're aware of this, Craig, but there were some amicus briefs filed with the court related to the Montana initiative statute that was 100 years old, that had banned corporate contributions to political campaigns for all that time. And one of the friend of the court briefs argued that the 11th Amendment really deprived the Supreme Court of jurisdiction unless the legislature of the state of Montana asked it to review this matter. And one of the attorneys who I interviewed at the time, Carl Mayer, indicated that when the case left Montana. It was titled in the name of the Attorney General. Oh no, it was titled Montana versus the organization that had brought the complaint. And when it arrived in Washington, the court name was somehow changed to reflect the individual name of the Attorney General, who is now the governor of Montana, and that appeared to be a way to escape the 11th Amendment requirement that deprived them of jurisdiction. Did anybody point that out to you?
Not to me. You've got much more inside information on the mechanizations of that case than I have. That's actually quite surprising. What I found startling about the whole case is the action of the Montana Supreme Court itself. I mean, two of the justices just basically rebuked the U.S. Supreme Court and, you know, said, we're not going to abide by Citizens United. And the one dissenting justice, the justice who said we have to agree with the Citizens United decision, he even wrote a dissenting opinion saying, of course corporations aren't people. We know that. You know, I mean, this is a ridiculous decision, but precedent makes me have to rule with the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I recall that.
That's not much of an endorsement for those five justices I've got right around the corner here.
Mm-hmm. Craig, finally, I'd like to see if you have a comment on what used to be called Obama for America. It was the campaign committee for the president's reelection last year. At least he didn't call it CREEP. And the committee has now morphed into one of these soft money political action groups. It's now called Organizing for America. And I'm still on their email list because they captured it during the campaign back in 08. And they are now trying to raise money in large chunks. They say that they'll voluntarily reveal the donors, but they don't have to by law. Corporate contributions will clearly be a part of the mix. And this is going to be used to try to motivate and activate supporters of the president, sometimes on issues that I probably support 100%. But I find this a very troubling development, to take a campaign apparatus and convert it into a soft money group that operates during the actual term of the president, not simply related to an election campaign. What's your comment on this?
This is going to be a problem for President Obama. If you recall the first time around, he also morphed his campaign committee into something that was much more ethical and was just, you know, funded by individuals and not by corporate money. You know, that was a little questionable, but, you know, at least you didn't have all that corporate money flowing in there. This time around, he is freely and willingly taking corporate money and unlimited amounts of corporate money. And even if he discloses that to the public, that isn't going to solve the problem. What is going to happen is we're going to see corporations like Chevron giving money to President Obama's new soft money group, and then if the president turns around and issues another government contract to Chevron, even if it wasn't influenced by the contribution, we're going to think it was. I mean, so this is just nothing but problems for the president, and it isn't going to do any good for, you know, developing public confidence in how our government operates. This is going to be a disaster.
And the only recourse the public has is to object to it and try to put a little sunlight on it?
Object to it and point out that even the sunlight isn't going to fix the problems that are going to be posed by this entity.
Mm-hmm.
This is a soft money entity, and one can only assume if someone's going to turn over $500,000 or $1 million to this entity, they want something in return. And if we see that happen, we are going to connect the dots, whether or not they are connected.
Yeah.
And this is not going to work out well for the president.
And on a similar note, did you see, it's a report from Mother Jones Magazine at the end of February, that the Democratic National Committee having pledged not to accept any corporate contributions to fund the nominating convention in Charlotte last year, came up short, and so they took a loan of $10 million from Duke Energy, which is based in Charlotte. And Mother Jones reports that since the committee couldn't repay Duke Energy, that it has now been essentially converted to a gift or a donation, and Duke Energy is planning to charge its ratepayers six of that $10 million as a cost of doing business. Craig, I mean, this is so insidious and just downright dirty that it makes clean coal sound like a true, honest statement.
You know, these reversals in Obama's position when it comes to taking corporate money are really just recent. You know, recall how proud I think most of us were of Obama when he scolded the Supreme Court justices for the Citizens United decision. You know, and he took strong stance against soft money, against corporate money, against the idea of corporate personhood. He even has endorsed the concept of a constitutional amendment. But within the last year, we've seen him backpedal and backpedal. You know, he banned corporate money in his first nominating convention. He's taken at quite a bit in the second one, not as much as the Republicans, but he's still taken a lot of corporate money. He's taken corporate money now for his inauguration, which he did not the first time around. And now he's set up a soft money group to continue for the next couple years. We've seen some very, very troubling reversals in Obama's stance when it comes to money and politics.
Yeah. Well, Craig, I want to thank you for the work that you do. Appreciate you joining us today. And take Chevron on, and let's see if we can fix at least this part of the problem.
Let's try.
All right. Take care, Peter. Craig Holman at Public Citizen, on the web at citizen.org. Thanks for listening to our latest in-depth interviews. Send your comments to humblehost@peterbcollins.com. That would be me.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.